It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Flags are incredibly controversial. They stir patriotism and loyalty and pride. Every state has one. I actually have a map that shows every state flag. But did you know that a lot of cities have one too? And did you know that the Milwaukee flag is so reviled that various groups in the city want to replace it? And did you know that this is such an important issue that the various constituencies that hate the flag can't agree on what to replace it with? And did you know this has been going on for years and just got punted into the summer of 2019? What is the deal here? What do you think of Milwaukee's current flag? Do you like it? Do you think it needs to go? What about the proposed design for the new Milwaukee flag? Do you like it? It's used in a lot of places. 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Steve Kotis is a senior designer at Zero Studios, and he led the initiative to adopt Milwaukee's new city flag. Steve, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So you were at the Milwaukee Common Council meeting last week where they talked about the possibility of a new flag. This decision was postponed. What happened here?
Basically, the Steering and Rules Committee, a subcommittee of the Common Council, deferred the final decision to the Milwaukee County Arts Board and Council. So they are an organization that works with the city for any public art, any statue that needs to go up, any mural. Basically, you know, they're experts in this realm of decision-making with the city's identity. So they have basically deferred the judgment until the end of the year.
So I'm looking at the flag that Milwaukee currently has and the flag that was proposed. The flag that Milwaukee currently has can be described as busy. That's pretty much my first reaction to that. How long has this flag been in existence?
Since 1954-55, it has been our banner. So, yes, in a word, it is busy.
It is busy. It's got the date 1846 on it. It's got what looks like a steamship, the name Milwaukee. For some reason, there's a spaceship in here. In the middle of a sprocket. Can you explain that one to me?
I believe that is some sort of symbol that was representative of the library or the Milwaukee library system. I think it has the word. So the banner that people typically see is a modern day simplified vector, believe it or not, sort of version. The original from the 50s has more detail in it. That particular symbol has the word knowledge underneath, which is where it, anyway. So,
okay.
Yes, very confusing, a lot going on, and, you know, really an example of design by committee. You know, we have to make everyone happy, so let's put all this stuff on it.
What is the new design look like? I'm looking at that also, and to me, it kind of looks like a sunset, and it doesn't have any words on it at all.
Right. It's actually the opposite, right? We're in Milwaukee, and the sun rises over Lake Michigan.
Mm.
So it is a sunrise over Lake Michigan, which symbolizes a new day, which is a really refreshing sentiment, right? Take a moment to kind of resonate on that, that the potential here is that our flag can literally look forward to a new day every day instead of looking past. And so there are three stripes in the sun's reflection, which symbolize Milwaukee's three rivers, the Milwaukee River, the Kinnickinnick, and the Menominee, as well as the three founding towns, Kilbourne Town, Juneau Town, Walker's Point. And then gold, the top, is symbolic of our brewing history, and white for peace and tranquility.
Interesting. This was postponed. This was the flag that was proposed to replace the really, really busy current Milwaukee flag, and it was postponed. How did you feel when that happened?
You know, I sort of expected it. You know, there's more process involved than just green lighting this thing, getting it through. Because this initiative was led by, you know, the people, a small group of citizens, and had the, not the 100% backing of the city, but rather they were aware. The mayor and the Common Council president announced the finalists back in 2016 when they went up to a vote. So the city was very aware of the process, but they didn't have a hand directly in, you know, the process. They were basically just, you know, made aware of it and were supportive of it.
So when we found ourselves hearing the news that this was postponed, our first reaction was, it's a flag. Like, why is a flag so controversial?
Well, you know, flags are, and flags have a lot of power. And I think people sort of, you know, we see them every day. We take them for, you know, granted a little bit, but they have tremendous power because they're meant to identify a large group of people or a city or a state or a province or a country. They are meant to create a sense of identity. And with that comes a lot of sort of tribal human characteristics, right? That to say that this is where I'm from. This is not this place. This is not that place. So with that comes a lot of deep subconscious sort of things that I think people don't really think about, and I think that's why, you know, the flags matter. And you know, this isn't something that should be, you know, addressed lightly. There should be due diligence had, and that's what we're seeing.
We've got Justin from Milwaukee asking a question. Justin, welcome to the program.
Hi there. I just want to comment. I do like the flag. It is less busy. I've been on the fence. I mean, I guess my biggest question is, have you released the design rights or the trademark or whatever so that if it is adopted by the county as our flag, anyone can print it without anyone personally profiting on it? But I do believe, you know, you absolutely should get credit for the design, but if it's going to be our flag for the next 50, 75 years, I don't think people should be profiting on the design.
So that's actually a good question. Did you design this flag, Steve?
I did not.
Okay.
I am a designer, but I did not design the flag. I simply led the initiative with which it came from. So
okay, so and I've seen this. It's called the People's Flag, and I've seen it around. So obviously people do print it off, but what are going to be the rights for people just to print it and use it?
Yeah, that's the whole point, right? It's free. It falls within Creative Commons Zero, and that this particular category, you know, flags fall under the United States flag. Any flag manufacturer anywhere in the world can make the United States flag, or any flag for that matter. And that's really the point is, you know, they're not trademarked and registered. They are open source symbols that are meant for people to use. And that was the point with this project. It was never about money. And we really, quite the opposite. We encourage the community to use it and print it and make their own products or make their own flags. This really just helps it become available, right?
Right. So Milwaukee is not the only city that had a flag issue this week. Madison also just approved a new flag last night. They replaced a symbol that some say appropriated in Native Americans' tribal culture, but they kept most of the original design. Do you have thoughts about other flags around the state, and perhaps even Wisconsin's state flag?
Yeah. I know that Eau Claire also went through a similar process, and they have a new flag within the last year or two. I was also aware of Madison's refresh, or rather update. I spoke with Alderman Maurice Cheeks about, you know, proposed ideas on how to simplify. But yeah, you know, with regard to Wisconsin's state flag, you know, it's another, in a word, uninspiring, right? It's our state seal on a field of blue, and there are about 15 other states that have basically the same design, right? A field of blue and the seal, and
right.
You know, seals are very complicated. They're meant to be on pieces of paper, and I'm not saying anything new here. It's uninspiring. You know, we look at states like Colorado, or we look at states like Arizona, right? Look at those state flags and tell me what you think. Those are, you know, beautifully designed, simple, memorable, durable, and because of that, they get used a lot, especially if you visit those states. You will see their flags everywhere, and it becomes a point of pride, right? And it becomes a distinguishing symbol, whereas if it's just a field of blue with our state seal, and then it has to say what state it represents because, of course, you're confused, there's no symbolism there. It's just, it's uninspiring. So I think there's always room to do better, and that's really the point of design, is to make our lives better, to make things more beautiful.
So it occurs to me that this fight over the old flag and the new flag may just be a fight over how people saw design 60 years ago and how they see it now. Like, this old Milwaukee flag wanted to represent everything about the city. You know, we've got a little farming here, a little library stuff. There's factories. There's Sprocket. There's a Sprocket sort of right in the middle of it because Milwaukee made things. There was shipping because that was an important part of the economy. They wanted it to be more representative. Whereas the newer flag is sort of like. It's a circle and with a gold background, and the specific meanings of these things aren't apparent. And that's just a different design aesthetic that we have these days.
I wouldn't say it's a different design aesthetic. What I would say is that it follows the sort of basic principles of flag design. Again, principles, not rules.
Okay.
Principles meaning that if you follow them, the end result will be more effective. So the biggest reason that makes, you know, flags important is symbolism. That means that simple color usage, compositional, you know, arrangements, they symbolize something greater than the design itself. We see this with the United States flag. You know, in third grade, fourth grade, whatever elementary school, you had to be taught the symbolism. 13 stripes for the 13 original colonies, the 50 stars for the 50 states, blue for, you know, from sea to shining sea, et cetera, et cetera. You have to be educated typically with flags and what do they mean. That's what creates a connection to them. And once you learn that symbolism, you typically are not going to forget. So there is a level of, it requires a little more of you, right? Because it is symbolic. The new flag is symbolic. And when you learn the symbolism, I think the message becomes clear, and I think your connection to it becomes stronger. And over time, it will only continue to gain value. And that's really a powerful thing.
So we're going to try and get these flags on our website at WPR.org, at least with a program note, so you can see what we are talking about. This flag decision is now going to be put off to the summer of 2019. Are there any other flag designs that may come up in the meantime?
With regard to Milwaukee?
Yeah. Or is it just between these two?
I can't imagine that there would be. Here's the funny thing is that the People's Flag, most folks believe it is the new flag. Most people call it the new Milwaukee flag. And it's been around for about 2 years. And in that 2 years, organizations like the Brewers have made merchandise and that is, you know, sold out. Milwaukee Brewing Company made a new beer called Milwaukee IPA, adorned with the flag's design. It's one of their best-selling beers. Those are just two examples of, like, big organizations. There are also plenty of other smaller local businesses that are using the design. And the more that happens, the harder I believe it becomes for us to try and start over. And really, what's the point? You know, I think the whole point of this project was to create a symbol that changes Milwaukee's narrative, right? Let's close a chapter in our book of history and open a new one and write a new one. And I think the new flag becomes a very universal representation of Milwaukee. It doesn't pertain to, you know, different industries or buildings and all that stuff, because those can come and go. And I think one of the main reasons why, you know, the Native Americans even came to this area before the settlers was its geographical location, its confluence by Lake Michigan and the Three Rivers. And I think those are things that attracted, you know.
Okay, so we have one caller on the line we're going to take in the next 2 minutes. Beth from Milwaukee, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. Yes, I think I agree with so much of what he said about the design and being symbolic, but I did not make the connection that it represented Milwaukee. I mean, it's a very nice design, but I didn't make that connection to the city.
Right. So thank you, Beth. So let's, we've got like a minute left here, Steve. The flag, maybe some people think it's too symbolic, that it doesn't connect specifically to Milwaukee. What do you say to that?
Well, I would say that it's new, right? Symbols take time to gain their equity. And I think that the same could have been said about the United States flag back when the country was being founded. So what I would say is, you know, you're right. And I think that over time that will change. Moreover, I would push you to look at Milwaukee's city seal. If you just Google Milwaukee's city seal, at the direct center of Milwaukee's city seal is the sun rising over Lake Michigan, which is sort of a happy accident in this instance, but a meaningful connection between our city's, you know, government and now the pride of the citizens. So it does represent Milwaukee, and I think, you know, it does so in a new way. So it will take time to, you know, gain that equity for some folks.
Steve Kotis is a senior designer at Zero Studios, a company based in New York and Milwaukee. He led the initiative to get the new flag for the city of Milwaukee adopted. Thank you for being here, Steve.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. There seems to be two kinds of people in the U.S. today, those who want to argue and those who want to avoid arguments at all costs. That doesn't seem like a recipe for getting things resolved. Our next guest, though, thinks that argument, constructive argument, is the only way out of the political and cultural quagmire we find ourselves in. Eric Liu is the founder and CEO of Citizen University. He's also the executive director of the Aspen Institute Citizenship and American Identity Program. He served as a White House speechwriter and policy advisor for President Bill Clinton. And he is the author, most recently, of You're More Powerful Than You Think, A Citizen's Guide to Making Change Happen. Eric Liu, welcome to the program.
So glad to be with you, Carrie.
So arguing, you've spoken a lot about arguing. You had a seminar at the Aspen Institute about how to argue well. We have a negative perception around the word, though. Why should we argue?
Well, I think, you know, the nature of our politics right now is that it's so polarized and so divided that people's natural instincts are to try to build bridges and find common ground. And I think that's really important. I think it's good. I applaud those who are trying to do that. But as I said in an article in The Atlantic right before the 2016 presidential election, you know, there are often times where a rush to reconciliation can be a dangerous thing. American history teaches us that. And if you think about the period after Reconstruction, when Reconstruction was getting really difficult and challenging, and there was this sudden surge of sentiment in both the North and the South among white citizens to reconcile, to return to reunion and really bridge these differences. And what that meant was that they were sacrificing the fledgling struggles of the freed slaves to this idea of reunion. And,
mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that we've got to remember is that American civic life is an argument, right? Inherently, it is an argument. There are a set of core tensions in American civic life between, for instance, liberty and equality. We like to think of those words as, you know, motherhood and apple pie, interchangeable ideas. But if you actually think about it, those are perpetually in tension. If liberty prevails in our debates, then we end up sacrificing equality, and vice versa. There's another core tension in American life between a Hamiltonian view of strong central government and a Jeffersonian view of limited government. Anybody who's a fan of the musical Hamilton can tell you about that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a core argument in American life between the idea of, just think about our national motto, between the pluribus side of our national motto and the unum side, the idea of, you know, we are focusing on our and celebrating our diversity, or we are focusing on our unity, right? Again, these are perpetually in tension, color blindness versus color consciousness, a federalist approach to government versus an anti-federalist approach, if you go all the way back to before.
So this is baked into how this country was set up. I wanted to go back though to when you were talking about Reconstruction, that there's a tendency, we have a tendency sometimes to just say, "Hey, go make up."
We'll just get along, right?
Yeah. When we're little, we're told, "Go make up with that person you just had a fight with." But you're arguing that reconciliation sometimes isn't the way to move forward. That constructive argument is. Talk to me about that.
Well, look, my view is that in American political life right now, there are deep, deep divides of worldview, philosophy, experience. We live in an age of profound, nearly unprecedented inequality. We live in an age where the social contract that we've had for 50, 60 years is unraveling. This is a time when we should be having fierce arguments and fierce debates about the role of the citizen and the role of government, about how what we owe each other in a changing society, about who is us. And that debate is not something we can just quickly skip past. And, you know, my bottom line way of putting it often is that we don't necessarily need fewer arguments in American civic life. We just need less stupid ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean to be glib there. When I say less stupid, I mean several things. I think, number one, as I was alluding to, we need arguments that are more grounded in a sense of history so that we recognize that some of those core American tensions that I was describing before are perpetually replaying themselves. The fight over the Affordable Care Act, the fight over immigration, the fight over tax cuts, all of these are recapitulations of these old, old American arguments. And if we can see that, we can recognize that the point of American politics isn't to achieve, quote, total victory by one side over the other, but it's to remember that American political life is a game of perpetual, infinite repeat play. And we've got to try to figure out how to make our arguments, but also recognize that the point is you're going to win some, you're going to lose some, and you're going to have to split the difference sometimes, but not that you're going to wipe the other team off the face of the earth, which is increasingly the spirit of our politics right now. But the second thing I would say is that what makes a less stupid argument, what I call a better argument, is also one that is more attuned to the emotional dynamics underlying any argument, being more emotionally intelligent about what it means to engage with somebody. And I think one of the lessons that we've learned in the Better Arguments Project that I run out of the Aspen Institute is not so much about how you argue, but rather how you listen.
Mm.
Our politics right now is corroded not so much by people making claims and making arguments, but it's corroded by the fact that so many people have forgotten willfully how to listen. Right? We listen with a certain, what I call, debater's ear. You listen only in as much as is needed to get the gist of what the other guy is saying so that you can prepare to demolish him, right? Rather than listening, in fact, to understand and, in fact, to kind of really see the world from the vantage point that this other person is expressing. And that habit of listening not to win but to understand is something that has fallen out of practice in American civic life, and we've got to rebuild it.
I want to talk about what makes a bad argument?
Well, I think if you ask anybody that, they don't have to be sophisticated students of American history or American politics. Everybody has probably fairly recently had a bad argument,
mm-hmm.
and they will tell you, the kinds of things that make an argument bad are, number one, just a rapid rush to judgment. Number two, this sense that you begin to lose control emotionally. And it really stops becoming about the thing itself and more just about protecting your own sense of identity or even dignity. What also can make a bad argument is when people are just rehearsing talking points that they've heard somewhere else or been programmed to repeat instead of actually dealing with the human across from them, right? And I think people would also say that what makes a bad argument is when both parties are basically in a race to shirk responsibility, right? To blame the other and never take on their own piece of how we got into this fight or what we or what might be weak in their own worldview or position. It's what the great psychologist C. Terry Warner calls accused excuse, right? I accuse you in order to excuse me and let me off the hook. That's a common pattern in bad arguments. And but again, most fundamentally, what makes a bad argument is when neither party is actually hearing the other or listening to the other. They're just in pure mutual assured destruction mode of I'm going to blast you with my best ammunition. And I think, again, our political culture right now both incentivizes that, it celebrates that, our TV culture rewards that. And so the spirit of our project, the Better Arguments Project, is a spirit that is very much grounded in place and in community, right? All across the state of Wisconsin right now, as people are listening, they're thinking not necessarily about life in Washington, D.C. or between the White House and the Congress. They're thinking about where they live. Whether it's Madison or wherever it may be, and they're thinking about what it means to live in a community where you've got to see people face-to-face, you've got to deal with them. You can't just flame them and torch them without penalty the way you might on social media. You've got to rehumanize the way that you argue with them and the way that you deal with them. And a bad argument is one where we just give up on the idea of humanization.
We are talking about what makes, we're talking about arguing and how arguing can bring us forward in this country and in our lives. I also want to reiterate, Eric Liu, the idea of listening. I think that it is a lost art, and most people don't realize how important it is. When you see people on TV, when you see people on stage, they are mostly listening to each other, not necessarily talking to each other. We have a lot of calls coming in here. I want to go to Greg from La Crosse. Greg, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Eric, after the election and after some of the grieving was took place, I decided I wanted to try to talk to people more, and I turned to my dad. We differ in a lot of ways. He's kind of a golden rule guy, a very subjective approach, and I had tried to talk with him some, and he just basically said, no, you know, I don't want to, we don't need to, there's no point. And I'm wondering what advice you might have for people like myself who do like to argue, understanding the different forms of argument, understanding that listening is important as well. Where might I be able to start off, again, approaching him? We have a good relationship. I just want to try to open the conversation more with him, and I think if I can do that, I can do a better job with other people as well.
Thank you for that, Greg. Isn't the golden rule, though, treat others as you would have them treat you?
And I think it's subjective, because what I want is what I'll do to others. And if my dad doesn't want to talk, then he's not going to talk to other people either.
Thank you for that, Greg. Eric?
Well, I think, first of all, I just appreciate Greg sharing that. I think there are a lot of folks and a lot of families, again, particularly in this time right now, that where everybody's emotions, at least about politics, are heightened, where you know, that they're experiencing something like that, where one person may want to engage in arguing, the other is just like, not going there. I don't even want to, you know, deal with that. And I think the counsel that I would offer is, in the first place, to not begin with the idea that, hey, I'd like to discuss issues with you or discuss, you know, something contentious with you. But really, just begin a conversation that is all about questions. And the questions that you want to pose are questions that, again, are about how is your worldview formed? How did you come to see the world the way you do? What experiences in your life? What positive experiences? What traumatic experiences? What great teachers and mentors? What tormentors or negative figures in your life? You know, asking questions like that draw out another person's story. Now, in this case, between a father and son, they may already know a lot about these stories of each other. And yet still, again, if we are genuinely curious, there's always more to ask in a way that is that number one draws the other person out, but number two again establishes this foundation of okay, now we've talked about how you know this particular experience shaped you or how this recent you know election debate you know made you decide that there's no point in engaging here. But we've kind of talked that first layer out a little bit, and that makes possible then, you know, a reciprocal notion of, hey, well, let me tell you how, you know, I see the world and explain, you know, where I'm coming from. And it doesn't even have to result in a quote-unquote debate. It just has to be a process of rehumanizing and recognizing where the other person is coming from and that they have a certain measure of humanity and dignity. And look, you know, I can anticipate some caller saying, what about if that other person that you're trying to do that with is someone who literally does not acknowledge your humanity or your dignity?
Ah.
You know, someone who has a you know, if you're an immigrant and this is somebody who is completely nativist and thinks immigrants are the bane of America's existence, or if you're a person of color and this person essentially is a white supremacist, how can you even be the one to acknowledge their humanity when they won't acknowledge yours? And you know what I would say quickly to that is to remember that even during the depths of Jim Crow in this country, you know, civil rights leaders, activists, people like Thurgood Marshall, the great lawyer who ultimately became a Supreme Court justice, but back in the 40s and 50s was working up and down the South, bringing cases on behalf of the NAACP. And when you read Justice Marshall's papers, you realize everywhere he went in the South, where he was encountering people who literally dehumanized him, who did not recognize him as human, he was building friendships, even with these people he was on the other side of. And he was listening to them. He was trying to understand them. He did not himself get exercised by them. He knew who he was. He was centered in his own sense of identity. And he was not naive. He understood the danger he was in, but he also understood that there was only one way to set in motion a positive feedback loop of increasing humanity, and that was for him to model it.
We are talking with Eric Liu about better ways to argue and the need for argument in our society. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us. We love tweets at WPR Mornings. Adam from Milwaukee wants to join the conversation. Welcome, Adam.
Hi, good morning. The comment about asking questions is a good segue for what I was going to bring up on air here. And that is, I think I'm like a lot of people. I don't want to argue. I don't want to be a professional debater. But I still want to have these important and critical conversations with people. So I was a bit frustrated that I didn't know how to do this. I stumbled upon some YouTube videos where they're using this conversational approach of asking, like, Socratic questions to have a cordial conversation about what people believe and why they believe it. And so I just wanted to mention that. It's called street epistemology, and maybe your guest has even heard of it. There's a lot of examples on YouTube, and it's, like I said, it's not a debate at all. It's about getting at what someone believes, how they came to believe it by asking questions, and coming to a greater mutual understanding of the topic at hand.
Asking questions, Eric. Thank you very much for that, Adam. Asking questions.
Yeah, I think Adam is really onto something, and it's not only about asking questions, but he talks about this, you know, the Socratic spirit. It is, again, asking questions that can draw out, you know, the truth from that person's angle and perspective. And asking creates such a different energy from asserting, right? And when you think about the you know, what makes a better argument? You've asked me, Carrie, what makes a bad argument?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our project, the Better Arguments Project, we've been conducting focus groups, for lack of a better word, all around the United States with young people, with older people, with people who are very experienced in politics and those who are not. We're preparing to go deep in several communities across the United States to spend a deep conversation with people about how in their locality, just rooted in community, what the culture of argumentation or the culture of engagement looks like and feels like there. And you know, Anchorage, Alaska, Dumas, Arkansas, Queens, New York, three very different places. But across all of these different kinds of conversations, we've learned four or five kind of core rules about what makes a better argument. One we've talked a little bit about, but I just want to name it, and that is take winning off the table. Right? And I cannot emphasize how important this is. If you are listening in order to win, if you are engaging somebody to win, you're going to get a dynamic in which the other side does not want to let you win. And they will use every tactic in the book, and they will refuse to acknowledge what they in their own hearts may know to be reality because they don't want to lose. But if you take winning off the table and replace it with understanding, hey, I want to engage you in this conversation. I want to ask you questions. Maybe I would even want to engage you in a debate, but not to win, just to understand where you're coming from. That's number one. I think a second thing that both Adam really speaks to and what the previous caller, Greg, really named was the idea of prioritizing relationships and listening passionately, like remembering that this is about human relationships, and you got to put those at the center and honor those relationships and the history of them. I think a third major tenet for a better argument is pay attention to context, right? The cultural context, the political context, the regional context. What will work, as a better argument, you know, in a Chinese-American family like the one I grew up in, might be different from what will work in a Scandinavian American family like so many in the upper Midwest and in Wisconsin. You know, a different vibe, a different style. The Queens argument is going to be very different from the Dumas, Arkansas argument. So pay attention to context. The fourth rule is this: embrace vulnerability. And again, both your callers already this morning have modeled that in ways that I think are super admirable. You know, acknowledge your own fear, acknowledge your own pain, acknowledge you know, the things that you're scared of doing or wading into, and that helps model it for the other side. And then the most important one, the fifth and final rule of a better argument, is that you've got to be willing to have your own mind be changed. It is impossible to change another person's mind if you're not willing to have your own mind changed. And yet, think about all the ways in which all the time we get into political and civic debates quite certain of our worldview, and the only objective is to move the other guy over to our side. You've got to have some willingness to shift, because otherwise the other party will smell that you don't and won't yield an inch for her part.
We are talking to Eric Liu, and we are taking your calls about how to have a better argument. 800-642-1234 or ideas@WPR.org is our email. We'll be back in a moment.